Butch. My name's Teresa. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Teresa.
From Hawaii. Isn't that beautiful? I just feel like all I'm going to do is just break down and cry, actually. What a perfect topic. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come out and speak. I'm so nervous. What else is new? And that's a good thing. I always say I never want to stop being nervous because it keeps me humble. It lets me know that God's running the show and not me. And that Teresa ain't about, you know, I'm not about to do this. God's moving me out of the way. Oh, boy. I'm on overload. I'm on emotional, full love overload. This is my first convention. Oh, man. When they asked me to come out and speak, I was like, oh, goodness. That's pretty huge. And I had never come before, and so I went through a lot of changes to get here, and I'm just so blessed to be here. I am truly a miracle. And I was sitting here, I kept goofing with some of the people from Hawaii, telling them, I don't know what to talk about on this topic. Why did they pick this for me? And I guess I'm really emotional because I'm thinking about what it was like. And I am such a miracle. You know, I always start off by saying, not only am I an alcoholic, I'm an adult child of an alcoholic, I'm an Al-Anon, I'm an incest survivor, I'm a codependent, I'm a workaholic, I got a whole lot of problems. And I was just so selfish, arrogant, egotistical little girl. You know, I had checked out of my body a long time ago, and I really am born addicted. My mother drank, and she didn't want me to be born, and I was born addicted, and I drank every day, all day. My whole life was about drinking. And it was about drinking and disrespecting you and disrespecting me, and I had no self-esteem and no self-worth, and I didn't know how to love anybody, let alone love myself. Talk about selfishness. I was so greedy. Everything was about me. I held people hostage. I used you. I manipulated you. I abused you. You know, I always try to figure out how I can get what I need to get. And there was always a hidden motive and a hidden intention. And if I wasn't going to gain anything out of this, I wasn't going to do it. And I knew I always had to be the one to win, regardless whether you lost and regardless whether you were hurt, it never mattered to me. I didn't know any other life other than that. Everyone in my family are alcoholics and addicts. Everyone has died from this disease. I was telling someone the other day that my, you know, good description of my family is when my aunt died in Puerto Rico, she didn't look right without a Budweiser can in her hand. And so we put one in there. And then she looked okay. And none of us thought anything was wrong with that. And we were like, that's Titi. She looks good now. There she goes. And we really felt she smiled after that. But she wasn't smiling. And we buried her with a Budweiser can. Could you imagine? Most of us, if we would have kept drinking, we would have died like that too, you know? And so when I think about my life and I think about what a miracle I am, that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous 15 years ago, I was 25 years old and just so self-obsessed and selfish and self-centered, and I was a mess, and I crawled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because this program is based on attraction rather than promotion. I had a mother in recovery. I had a cousin in recovery. And I used to come to these meetings, and we talk about the joy of helping others, of not truly understanding the attraction and how significant it is. In these rooms and outside of these rooms. I used to come to visit to California. I lived, born and raised in New York City. And I would go to visit from California. And when I would go visit, I would go to the meetings. And I would go to the dances and the musician picnics and all the events, the AA events. And I was drinking. I was drinking before the meeting, during the meeting, and after the meeting. But when I was sick and tired of being sick and tired of being sick and tired, I remembered those faces. I never knew that the seed was being planted. I really didn't. I remember talking about you, making fun of you, but I didn't realize that when I was ready, that's all I saw was the faces of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I saw their smiles, and I saw their gleam, and I saw that no one ever shunned me or looked down on me or shook their head at me. And so I came here, even though I came full of shame, I felt so dirty and so empty, I just couldn't go another day. I heard an old-timer say demoralization is a whole lot of things, but when you can't get drunk and you can't get sober, it's really bad. And that's how I was. And I had nowhere else to go. And I came to the very people that I knew where they were smiling and they were laughing and they seemed to be okay with me even though I was dirty and filthy and nasty. And I crawled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came on a Greyhound bus all the way from New York to California. I thought everybody in California was sober. That's all I thought. California was a sober place. That's what I thought. And I detoxed on that bus. I sweated on that bus and I shook on that bus. I was wearing a size 1 pair of pants with 2 pants underneath. I was 4 months pregnant with a dead baby in my belly. I didn't know it at the time. I was on my 4th child. My womb was so polluted. I had lost so many children and I was just looking pitiful. And I came into the room and still with an attitude and said, "Don't look at my outfit. I'm kind of going through a crisis." So vain and superficial. And it was all of you who had come before me that had taught me what it was to help somebody else. I sat in the back of the room and I didn't want to stand up as a newcomer, and there was a woman taking a cake, and Marcy, she's passed on now from Crenshaw and Lano, and she helped so many newcomers. That woman was an attraction and a role model to me because she helped everyone who walked in that door, no matter how you looked, no matter what you had on. And she left from the podium and she walked to the back of the room and she said, "Girl, you will stand up and state your name and your disease." And that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother dropped me off there, and I always say that I feel like a baby in a baby basket. My mother dropped me off in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous to the very people who had saved her life, and she left me. And all the old-timers, all the people who had been there just cradled me. And they told me to sit down, shut up and listen, take the cotton out of my ears, put it in my mouth, because my best thinking got me there. And they sat me in the front. They taught me how to sweep the floor and empty the ashtrays and fold the chairs and extend my hand and to make coffee. And that was all I was allowed to do, actually. I got sober in Crenshaw and Lano in 9604, and they were pretty tough. They didn't let me share for a whole year. Jay likes this one. Anytime I had something to say or raise my hand, they go, "What do you got to talk about? All you know is what it was like, what it was like, what it was like. Sit down somewhere." That's what they would tell me. This podium is sacred. You share your experience, strength, and hope. And they taught me how to dress because, you see, all I knew was I was physically abused, emotionally abused, sexually abused, and I never owned my body, and all I knew was that's the only way to get you to love me, whether you were beating me or molesting me. And so I didn't know any better, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous for you to teach me how to be a lady. And I remember walking in the room half naked with fishnet stockings and spandex skirt and bustier and big old high heel shoes with rhinestones and prancing in the meeting, boy, just trying to get some attention because that's the only way I knew how. And the old timers say, "Look like somebody got some issues." "Where are your clothes at, girl? What you came up in here looking for?" "Well, put some clothes on," and I would have to run home and get dressed. You taught me how to dress. And I was kidnapped. And you would say, "Come with me and go here and go there," and I would just follow. I had nowhere else to go. And as a result of that, it was the little things that I was taught. It was the little things about going to the podium and reading. I always share this because I would come up and want to study, you know, this chapter so that when you ask me to read, I can recite it and know it by memory. And I would be so excited and they'd say, "Okay, Teresa, you know, you can read." And I'd come up like, "Ooh, okay, I've been working on this for a while." And I would start reading, you know, with my head up, and they'll go, "Excuse me, we didn't say recite, we said read." Those things were so significant because I learned how to follow direction. I learned how to sit down in that chair and pay attention to what was going on up here and not worry about who was going to the bathroom and who was walking around and who was coming in and out of the room. They told me to listen like the dying only could. They gave me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and told me that it was unity, recovery, and service. That I had a disease of a threefold nature and I needed to do all three to treat my disease. Man, I've taken this program literal. I know that they talk about in the 12 and 12 that's so important. It talks about, not even that in our big book, about how to be of service. But I first needed to get rid of selfishness before I can be of service. See, before I can even be able to help you, I had to clean house. I didn't know how to help you when I came here. I knew how to use you. I knew how to take advantage of you. I knew how to manipulate you. But I didn't know how to help anybody until you helped me first. I heard you say, let us love you so you can learn to love yourself. And you loved me. You spoon-fed me. You taught me. You gave me these 12 steps and these 12 traditions. You know, the 12 traditions to me are like huge. They really taught me how to be in unity with others. Because I never knew how to do that, ever. Either you were above me or you were beneath me. I didn't know how to be a part of a team. And the 12 traditions taught me that. The 12 steps helped me to go within and to look at me and to understand that I was blocked from the sunlight of the Spirit. And that I couldn't let God come into this heart and into this body unless I got rid of the junk, the toxic, nasty stuff that just hung out inside my soul. I had to get down to the causes and conditions of my drinking. Drinking is only but a symptom. And when I did that, things started changing for me. I literally started doing stuff for you, but I wasn't looking for anything back. I just started suiting up and showing up. And I did the footwork. And when someone asked me to show up and have a commitment, I did it. I didn't do it any hidden motive. I didn't need hidden agenda. I just showed up and I just did it. And this thing called getting rid of selfishness started kicking in. This thing called unconditional love started happening to me. And it's as a result of the 12 steps. And I was just amazed. I always say, I am baffled that I can handle situations that used to baffle me. That blows me away every time. And I just started doing things for others. And I enjoy being a secretary and a treasurer and a coffee person and a cake person. You know, and at some level, all I've ever wanted in my life was to be loved, really. All I wanted was somebody to love me. Jeez. And I didn't know that all I had to do was take the eyes off of myself and put them on others, and I would receive an abundant amount of love. Talk about the joy of helping others. My life is just so full because I just show up for people. I just do what's in front of me, and I go wherever God will have me go. You know, I say I met my higher power in my fifth year of sobriety, butt naked, alone, with a white flag up my ass. It was extremely painful. Talk about surrender. That was like beyond surrender. That's when Teresa stopped running the show. And I haven't been confused since who's doing it. And I realized that whatever it is that I want to do doesn't usually work out. And so I go, okay, God, what are we doing today? I mean, it's down to the simplest thing. If I want to go shopping at the mall, I just want to go shopping to buy myself something. I never get there. I end up doing, somebody calls me for this, or somebody calls me for that, or we end up doing that. I never get to the mall. But the strangest thing is, then somebody comes and say, I wanted a blouse, and I just wanted to go to the mall to get a blouse. But a phone call, or a sponsee, or somebody in the program, or they want me to show up and speak somewhere, or they need somebody to do a 12-step call, and I just go and I do it instead. I don't say, no, I want to go, I was going to the mall. I go, okay, forget about the blouse, let's go over here. And then they do that, and then next thing you know, somebody turns around, they give me a blouse. Those things are huge. That's a lesson. I end up getting that blouse anyway. The gifts that I have received in Alcoholics Anonymous is huge. You know, I was like, geez, I don't have any hidden motives of being of service and helping anybody. You know, I was at a convention recently and I could bring my partner with me and she couldn't come, and so I bought my sponsee. And there was someone there and they were like, oh, is that your partner? And I was like, no. They were like, oh, because you just seem like you love each other so much. I was like, that's my sponsee. I love her. as you loved me. I can only do what you gave me. I can only give back what you so freely gave to me. I mimic that. You know, I always say in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the women, you have shown me what a mother looks like, what a sister looks like, what a cousin, what an aunt, what a friend. You are my reflection. You are my mirror. I dance with you. All the women in the room are my mirrors, and I learn from you. And then all the men, you've taught me what a father looks like, what a brother looks like, what an uncle looks like. Alcoholics Anonymous is my family. I am a baby of Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up literally in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm about 15 years old emotionally. I came in here emotionally an infant. And so I watch you. I watch how you help other people. I watch how you didn't make a big deal when somebody would come in pushing a cart, smelling funky, and you would tell them to keep coming back. Would you like some coffee? Would you like some donuts? I learned that from you, how to do that and how to hug them anyway. If I would have seen different, maybe I would have did different. But I saw that, and that taught me not to judge other people, to extend my hand wherever possible. Nobody ever shunned me or pushed me away. I learned that when I'm out in the street, I say hello to everybody and I smile. And then I get to be an attraction of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have so much joy just emanating the beauty of the sunlight of the Spirit that God has blessed me with. In this room and outside of this room, wherever I go, I want to represent Alcoholics Anonymous to show that this program works. And I put my hand out wherever I can, that I am a trusted servant, that God is my employer. When I show up to work, you've helped me to become an employee. You've helped me to become a daughter, a sister, an aunt. You know, today my mother has the beginnings of Alzheimer's, and my dad has emphysema and Parkinson's, and you taught me how to show up for them. And when mommy can't remember to have patience and compassion and tolerance, the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not be so selfish and want mommy to be there for me, because that's my mommy. Listen to me, mommy. Pay attention to me. Come on, daddy. Stop shaking. Why are you doing that, daddy? And I get to have compassion. I go, how can I help you today, daddy? What do you need? Are you hungry? Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that, and I feel good because you see them smile, and you see that, you know, they're just so happy. And when mommy's all over the place, I could just go, okay, what is it that you need? And let me think about them. Let me think about what they're going through and their illness and how much of a challenge it is for them. Let me see them in beauty and light and spirit. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that, and I'm not looking for anything back. And the other thing that I've noticed is, you know, I was telling somebody, this is like amazing to me. You know, I've been speaking in so many places. And when I get done, people stand online and they give me these hugs or these tears are coming from their eyes. Or they're smiling from ear to ear and they get this other level of hope. They get another moment of hope. And I see God. It's not like I see old Teresa got it going on. I get emotional because I'm like, wow, look at God using me as a vessel and a conduit to carry the message of hope. And God is awesome. A drunk like me giving you hope when I'm usually trying to rip you off. That's what I know how to do. And so I always say I see God in that. And I'm like, wow, that is so beautiful. The tears that fall from your eyes or what you feel, that, you know, that light shining in your heart, that's God. I get joy out of that. I get joy out of seeing God's work. I listen to Bill and I listen to Dr. Bob saying, don't ever get complacent and always be of service. I got an opportunity to go to Dr. Bob's house. I sat in there and just cried. It was because of their selflessness that allowed me to be here today. And how all the struggles and the changes that they went through in the beginning, and look at what we have today. This is just so awesome. I'm on overload. There's so many people here who, yes, at some level I have touched your life, but there's so much love that you give back to me that so many people feel that I'm doing so much for them. And it's like, geez, you have no idea what you're doing for me. No idea. I love my sponsees. I show up for them. I open up the big book. I don't want to change the words of these programs. I've taken it literal. I don't need to revise it or change it. I don't make up my own words. I use the ones that are in the book. I'm a copycat. I do. I repeat it all the time. People always say, oh, big book thumpers, quotes all the time. I don't know another language. I'm sorry. Why make up some new words? They seem to work. They just do. That's why I love this program. It's that simple. I don't have to be a genius. My sponsors are going through something. Okay, let's look at this page right here. We could do this. I don't have to know anything. It's a simple program for complicated people. And every time I take them through the steps, and every time I take them through the book, I'm taking me through that process too. And I'm just shocked and amazed, and I learned something new. And some of my sponsees is hysterical, because when I go through it with them, I'm like, did you hear that? Wow, that's intense. Did you get that? And they're like, okay, Teresa. Get a little excited. I'm like, this program works. It works. You see it? Did you hear it? And then I get to see them blossom, and I get to see these flowers grow, and they're just so beautiful, these women, and they're in gratitude of me, but it's just because I just showed up and I just did what you told me to do. And I tell them it's because they found a God in their life. And God gets to use me to carry the message. And that is the joy, is to see their life change, to see them get reunited with their families. And I've been in situations where some people didn't get it. And they choose to go back out and be in pain. I've seen people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in pain because they don't want a clean house. But I get to love you anyway. That's what you taught me. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to learn from you. I learned what I want to be like and what I don't want to be like. Both are significant. And I don't hold you accountable at any level. I've learned not to judge you because of that. I just love you for teaching me. Thank you for being my teacher. I get to be humble. I get to be teachable. I get to be honest, open-minded, and willing. I get to come in here in this robe and tell you my truth, and you love me anyway. And I get to listen to you and love you anyway. And this is the joy of helping others. When people recover and rooms get bigger and bigger and they grow and they grow and it's all over the world. That within itself is so joyful, because not only are we recovered is how I look at it, I'm just picturing how many families are healing as a result of that. In the millions. And that's huge. And so, I guess for me, my experience of the joy of helping others is the gratitude that I receive, that I continue to have hope again in my life. I get to continue to recognize that it is but a daily reprieve. But for the grace of God, that this is a precious, precious gift that's been given to me. And I don't ever want to take it for granted. And the only way not to do that is to continue to give back what was so freely given to me. And to suit up and show up and sit in those meetings to let a newcomer know that this program works. And as I continue to do that, I get to stay sober too. And that is just enough. That I am sober today. That's huge. And so thank you so much, each and every one of you, for loving me. And I really, really mean that. You guys love me so much. And yes, I share with you everything that I have. And in return, you just continue to love me. And I just want to thank you, each and every one of you, for being here and supporting me. And I always continue to ask that I stay teachable, humble, willing, and honest. Thank you.
Geez, couldn't they get a little more enthusiastic? Could we thank Kevin and Teresa one more time? Thank you. When I received my loving invitation to do this meeting, there was a suggestion that I might like to share some of my experience, strength, and hope in between the three speakers. But unfortunately, I come from North Vancouver, British Columbia, and or I did. I've moved since, and I moved last year. But in any case, that's where I grew up in AA, and one of my mentors is here, and he reminded me, as he always likes to do in his gentle fashion, that chair people chair, and speakers speak. I knew I was going to have difficulty complying with that kind of those kinds of instructions in the first place, and to have him here has certainly changed that.
My name's Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic. I haven't had a drink. Oh, no. No, the crackheads are here. No. The tweakers are back. No. I haven't had a drink since April 22nd, 1985, because Alcoholics Anonymous and you people. I have a great opportunity I want to take advantage of today. I have a friend in the room who I really admire. He's a very committed, enthusiastic member of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is 7 years old, and he turned 50 yesterday. His name's Harry H., and I want him to stand up. He's not going to stand up, but I want to just give him a little round of applause. Not a guy who drops by once a year for a cake. Great member of AA. I love you, Harry. Well, no, welcome to the newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm suspect of you if you're at this meeting. guy walked up to me some years ago. He said, what do you think of having sex with newcomers? And I said, well, I tell you what. Instead of having sex with a newcomer, go to a local hospital. Go to intensive care, find a woman on life support, unplug her, have sex with her, and then plug her back in again. It's the same deal. It's a good thing. Story I love to tell. I met a newcomer. This is years ago, early in my sobriety. I was doing 12-step work in my first couple of years, and this met him. He called me when I got home. He talked to me for an hour. I said, four times so he'd know I wasn't dead. This was one of these guys. You know these guys that talk to you? If you died, they would talk to the coroner when the coroner came up. We had one guy, my kids were so used to hearing this guy's voice on the phone, and he called. We were watching a playoff game. They were little boys, and they heard his voice on the machine, and both my sons went, "Drink! Drink! Drink!" They were done with this guy. Absolutely done with him. And this guy went a couple of weeks, and he talked to me. He had a lot of problems. He had been stalking several women. He had restraining orders out against him. And at the end of the hour of talking to me, he says, "Oh, I feel so alone." And I said to him, "What are you talking about? I don't even know you. I just listened to you for an hour without interrupting you. What do you mean you feel alone?" And he said, "Well, I don't have a woman." And I said to him, "What would you be bringing to a relationship right now besides stalking skills? What are you bringing to the deal?" People in remission from leukemia for a couple of weeks are not having dating problems. Alcoholics are, because our problem mainly rests in our mind. Sex, security, and society, it's a quote from the section on the fourth step from the 12 and 12. And it's very meaningful and very important and very powerful. Because what I did as a result of suffering from this horrible soul sickness the spiritual tapeworm that ate me up from the inside and left me hollow and insane and alone, is these natural instincts, which are God-given and therefore good, I attach them all to power and to self-seeking and terror and this inexplicable ability to have a drink when I knew that the attendant misery and suffering followed each and every time, and my alcoholism would go below the horizon, it would stop presenting as a real piece of business, and I would drink again. I would act without reason. I would act without explanation. And I injured myself, and I injured a lot of other people. And what's happened as a result of the incredible treatment for alcoholism, and I'm told to look at the interior of that soul sickness, resentments, the defects of character that make them possible, fears and sexual misconduct. If you're new, you get to do a sexual inventory. I'm sure that's great news for you. Especially you crackheads, because cocaine is an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. It's time to stop. They're dead. It's time to stop. Time to stop. It looks like the beginning of a CSI episode, so I'm going to stop. That's love. There's nothing wrong with being amorous, but the minute I connect power to sexuality, it becomes a defect of character. It becomes lust. There's nothing wrong with being hungry. Connect power to it, it becomes gluttony. Anytime I take any of these urges and I attach power to them, they become a horrible soul sickness that will, it's no big thing. It just plucks me beyond the opportunity of being helped by well-meaning clergy, medical doctors, people who love me, and I die. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love my home group. I've always loved my home group. And, you know, early on in my home group, there were a bunch of sexual predators. And unfortunately, the traditions were not exercised sufficiently at that home group to really get these people out of the situation. I really firmly believe that the group comes before the individual. And it was really unfortunate in that situation that some people were allowed that the, you know, we've heard it today. I mean, going to AA to find a lover really is like going to a nut house to find a business partner, in a way. And yet, I've seen some of the most successful relationships take place and happen and grow in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of the relationships I admire the most. You know, my wife and I have been married for 29 years. We got our anniversary was last week. In part because we've never wanted to get divorced at the same time. And There's some timing involved here. You told us not to get involved in our first year, and we didn't. We really stayed away from each other. We were just broken. I have not committed adultery since before April 22nd, 1985. With me, and this is just in my situation, when early on in sobriety, I had a bad deal with some guys. It was kind of like, well, you overeat, you gamble, you cheat, you do this, but we're sober. You can do anything you want in sobriety, as long as you're willing to pay the price. What a nutty idea. And I'll tell you, to me, why it's so nutty. The conceit there is that you'll be able to pay the price. That's like when a newcomer says, well, if I'll drink, I'll go to Tobago. I don't know. Why do you think you know what you'll do if you drink? The whole big book of AA is virtually the whole book is engineered to drive home the point is that you'll have absolutely no idea, you know, what you're going to do. At any rate, I had nothing to bring to my marriage when I got sober. Absolutely nothing. I was absolutely nuts. I didn't know how to talk to my wife. I didn't know how to fight. I was a bad, dirty fighter, you know. And I would either scream until she shut up or I would cry until she shut up. Either one. I like to cry. It's the tyranny of helplessness. I've always enjoyed that. I like to loom. I'm a loomer. I like to get a light behind me so she's in a shadow while I'm looming. Right? If I can work a loom, a cry, and a scream into one fight, that's a hat trick. That's communication. That's the Scott Redmond couples retreat right there. Loom, scream, cry. I got nothing. And I think somewhere in the back of my twisted noodle, because I don't clean my house. I'm a pig. I eat in the bathroom. I mean, who wants to live with this? I think somewhere in the back of my head that a certain amount of housework, if I deign to do some housework, should equal a certain amount of sex. That there should be like conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of a house to sex. So. Some putz out there is going, marketing, marketing, marketing. This is great. I'm bringing nothing to my marriage. My sponsor, in his loving, kind way, and didn't tell me to do this, but basically his deal was, will you leave her alone? Just leave her alone. Let's go. Let's go to a meeting. We're going to a panel. Let's go to a panel. Come on. Let's go. And he didn't beg me. I just followed, you know. And we were in a program about a year, and my wife's sponsor, who is I adore, my wife's been a committed member of Al-Anon. She just had her 20th Al-Anon birthday. And her sponsor had a computer program that printed out a banner. And I think she just replaced the names with different names. She had this kind of wired in. I came home one day and there was a banner over our bed that said, "Hey Scott, wanna blank?" And there was not a blank. It was a very specific suggestion. And Ruby got us together. And we needed the banner. I'm telling you right now. We needed a brass band is what we needed, but we got the banner. these defects of character that I continue to try to tether power to that still block and really diminish the quality of my life. And 20 years in, and I'm still, I was my kind of, so kind of a dear friend of mine heard my inventory this morning. I had a resentment against my son, or one of my sons, for doing something, and a resentment against my wife for something. And in the defects that I wrote about this resentment against my wife this morning, a new defect, I'd never written it before, scorekeeper. Scorekeeper came out of my mind. Whoa! I cannot have a successful relationship with a sponsee, with a sponsor, with an employer, an employee, or my wife if I'm keeping score. I can't. I'm supposed to give whatever I have to give here for fun and for free all the time. I can't have a successful relationship with anybody if I'm 50% of the relationship. I've got to give 100% of what I've got. And I've got to do that for fun and for free. And it was so great writing that defect. He and I got a kick out of it this morning. I said, man, this is a new one on me, you know. And so it's an interesting thing. There's certain kinds of thinking. After I got sober at 33, I started practicing my alcoholism at about 11, 12 years old. I started drinking and taking drugs at 13, 14 regularly. And what happened to my brain, because I practiced this sickness for so long, is that my knee-jerk reactions to things sometimes are bad ideas. They're just bad ideas, you know? And when I got sober, our sons were 6 and 3, and they're now 27 and 24. And when my son Michael was looking into what college he'd go to, this is after he had come back from working with the Zapatista revolutionaries in Mexico, in Chiapas, because he felt I just wasn't terrified enough, you know. Sex, security, and society. I want a relationship with my son. He's in Chiapas. I'm resentful at the Mexican military for trying to kill my son. I didn't get the memo that morning, but that's in my brain. All I have to do is have it right here and I get to die. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. Now, what is it in me? What is it in me that if God could come down and remove and just touch me with a magic wand, it would be gone? I'm not living in today. I'm selfish, I'm self-seeking, I'm frightened. I'm not trusting in God. I would cheat my son out of this. My sponsor said, it could be the greatest thing he ever does. I don't know if it is, but it was really cool. And when he came back here, he came back fully cut cloth. You know, and I block myself off from that relationship. And I even start getting nuts about people I think might like the Mexican military. I mean, it's just... I grew up in a Jewish home. I want to welcome... It's amazing to me that there are any Jews here. Jews don't drink. We know... We don't drink because it might dull the pain, and we certainly don't want to squander any agony opportunity that presents itself. But I'm glad that you showed up. Just out of the goodness of your heart, you Hebrews. Very glad you're here. And on my inventory, I had a lot of stuff about Nazi Germany. I was terrified about it when I was a kid. I saw these horrible films in Hebrew school. It was a bad deal for me. And on my inventory, I wrote, I'm resentful at Nazis for slaughtering Jews during World War II. It affects everything. And what are the defects? Let's try nothing. How about nothing? And my sponsor said, what are you talking about? I said, what are you talking about? I'm talking about Nazis. He said, you don't understand the question that's being asked you. You don't get it. You're not walking through the triumphant arch to freedom. You don't get it, okay? They're not asking you if the event was your fault. They're asking you if the resentment is your fault. Is the event my fault in this situation? Absolutely not. Is the resentment my fault? Every time, with no loophole and no exception. Because I don't just hate stuff. I hate stuff so that when I hate, I wake up, I water the hatred like a little flower. I want to make sure it's developing and just growing and robust, right? The worst thing is when I forget to hate something, you know? That's horrible. Horrible. And a guy goes, hi. And I go, hi. Oh, I hate him. Why did I do that? Why? Why? Now I'm going to have to redouble my glowering and sneering and snubbing. I hate so that when my head hits the pillow, it becomes a rotisserie. It eats my heart and my brain and turns my life black and throws me out of my own life. And my sponsor changed my life in that moment, that day. Now, sometimes the resentment is that fault, is the event my fault? Plenty. And sometimes not. I was an opportunist. I used this thing about Nazis to my own advantage in a couple of ways. I was filled with self-pity, retaliation. I was a racist. I was a hypocrite. Not fun. I was irresponsible because I just talk a lot of long crap and not do anything about anything. Sex, security, and sobriety. I so injured myself. You know, it's funny. It's like my friend Bob says, you know, when you borrow something from somebody and, you know, you tell him you need the money because, you know he's got a lot of dough. You know, and you'll give it to him when your tax return comes in. So your tax return either never comes in because there never was one, or you take it and you spend it on something else. So now you got to kill the guy. He's got to die. And every time he comes around in the lazy Susan of your brain, he's a hosebag. What's he want? You know, he's not a good guy. I got to kill him every time he comes around. Or I got to kill me because I've done something that I'm filled with remorse for. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there were thousands of people I had to kill. And thousands of deaths that I had to suffer. And I will tell you this. I've been in psychotherapy for 18 years, making the colossal mistake of trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy. I got no beef with therapy. Treating alcoholism with it is like showing up at a gunfight with a knife. Just getting these colossal ass poundings, you know? And when I came into AA, I was so broken. My back was broken over this, and I didn't know that as I shared this experience with another man, that he was going to start benefiting from my terrible days. My terrible days. And eventually, he would have stopped probably benefiting from it if I hadn't started to seek the solution. Because after a while, if I stay in my terrible days and I don't seek that solution, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and I start using AA as a self-help group. I've gone to therapy. I've gone to other 12-step groups. I've done a bunch of stuff, not instead of AA. I've never had outside help in AA. It's all because of what has happened to me because of AA. I went up over 300 pounds in sobriety. My wife and I had a lot of problems. My sons had a lot of adventures. I've had to switch sponsors. I've had to switch home groups. I've done a lot of stuff, and I have been a seeker because those are the guys who I've been hanging around with. You know, I sponsored a guy named Mike for a while, and Mike was like one of those great guys. One of those great guys who comes into your home group. He looked like he had been fired from a cannon, you know, and just one of those crackheads where every part of his face is moving in a different direction. He just, you know, looked like Foghorn Leghorn. It just like done one of that with him. And great guy, just a great guy. And we watched him put his life together. You know, when a guy gets lit up with it, it's exciting. He was living on his crack dealer's floor when he came in. And I pick him up for the home group, before the home group every week, and I was sponsoring him. And one day he turns to me, he's 2 years sober, and he says, you know, I met a girl a couple of months ago, and she's pregnant, and we want to have this baby and get married. What do you think? And you know what? If he had been a sexual predator, I might have said something else. If he had been a different guy, I might have said something else. I don't know. I just know that I had no resentment or no axe to grind with this guy, and I took a breath and I said, what do you want to do? What do you want to do? I'm with you. I'm with you. I'll come to your wedding, or I'll, you know, what do you want to do? And they had the baby and they got married, and I was the best man. And you know how a group can get really excited about this kind of thing, and the baby got born, and the baby was incredibly ill. I mean, at death's door. And the baby was taken to the hospital in neonatal intensive care and put on an extremely invasive deal. It was not a good thing. And the AA Army showed up. You know, you got to be a member of the family to go to neonatal intensive care, and her relatives have shown up. You know, it's a 6'6" Ethiopian men, big tall German drummers, overweight Jewish guys. And the nurses, after a while, would go, "Don't pause to lie, just go in." It was astounding. 2 weeks after the baby was home, they called this guy and said, look, because the call had gone out for blood, said, look, they're still coming with blood. They're dropping it off in jars, you know. They're like, you know, most of us can't even give blood because we're ex-hypes and we got fresh ink, so you can't give it anyway, you know. But we want to go so we get pissed off that they won't take our blood, you know. Damn it! Give me my blood. Did that couple make it? No, they didn't make it. They're having, boy, a marriage that didn't make it. What a shock in our day and age, right? But look at the demonstration that happened. People see that child who's still got a little nick on her neck from what she had to go through, and they break down crying. You know, they look at this incredible outpouring of love that had an effect, huge effect. Seriously, on hundreds of people. We don't even know what we're doing when we do it. When we decide to get back involved with society, and our other speakers have talked about it, you know, I throw myself into working with others when the yield would be incredibly detrimental to me. Now I've got to work with newcomers, and love them and not be pissed off at them. And they act like them all the time. They act, hi, how are you? He asked how I was. What am I going to say? I mean, that's how I say it. I'm fine. I'm fine. I guess I'm fine. I had a guy, I swear I could have said, my wife's on fire and running around the room. He would have, oh, really? I got a problem with my transmission. I had a guy was so crazy one time. He would start going out with a woman and then start thinking about what she'd be like 30 years from now. I mean, and I said to him one day, I was on the phone, I said, I got it. Listen to me, bud. You need a dead woman. You need a dead woman. She's not going to change. Get a dead one. So to get re-involved with the world, to get re-involved with you, you see, I have not had a drink since April 22nd, 1985. My alcoholism has stayed above the horizon as a real piece of business, not a complaint. I've had other things that have remained complaints, and I've had to do some work on those, you know. But to keep it as a real piece of business, which means you stop. If you're new, and you're not drinking, the not drinking part is a moose. If it was not for the not drinking part, we'd be a much bigger organization. I want to guarantee you that right now. our ranks would swell if it wasn't for this gall darn not drinking thing. But my alcoholism has stayed above the horizon as a real piece of business. And in the old days, I couldn't keep it up there. I mean, sometimes it would stay aloft because a child got born or something horrible had happened or something wonderful had happened. But my alcoholism has stayed present and real as a real piece of business for 20 years because it's been balanced on the heads and shoulders of the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that connective tissue, what a crazy idea that the friends, and there's so many people here today that I adore and I have really very incredible relationships with. How crazy an idea is it for me to think that when we have that connection, if you take us out of that equation, that connection doesn't exist. It's the face and the breath of God. It's the connective tissue. And if you're new here, if you're not drinking, I want to urge you to be as opportunistic as you possibly can, to do as much as you can, to get involved in this incredible cycle of surrender and commitment, and to use a few simple spiritual tools to move you away from the cycle of spree and remorse. And as we get back into life, into the mainstream of life, nowhere in the big book of AA does it say that the road gets narrower. It says, join us on the firing line of life. Help us to pack things into the mainstream of life. It says, become part of the big reality, the great idea. If you're new, I want to urge you as much as I can. What time you got, man? Okay, cool. I want to urge you as much as I possibly can. You know, it's a funny thing. My first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, who I only had for a couple of months, showed a bad piece of judgment. I was involved in show business at the time, and he took me for the first two steps, and when he got me to the third step, he said a prayer with me, and then we got up and he said, you know what, I've done something for you, I'd like you to do something for me, and I'd like you to get me involved in show business. And I could have taken that thing and I could have gotten out of here lickety split. And I knew there was something wrong about it. I knew there was something way off. And of course, when I talked to some trustworthy people in Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, he made a mistake. He made a big mistake. So if you come in here and somebody acts inappropriately to you, if you come in here and somebody is not involved in doing the work and they're drilling a hole in your boat, all I can tell you is that there are plenty of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who have experienced the touch of the Master's hand and are doing whatever they can to pass that gift on. If you're new, I want to... I want to urge you as much as I possibly can to take this thing as seriously as you possibly can and go out there and have the time of your life. Welcome to AA. Welcome home. Thanks so much.